On the board, more or less the underlying thesis of these lectures, I believe God has spoken to us His law word in the scriptures, especially also for economics. And here we have on the left man's obedient response to God's economic law word for creation, which results in God's blessing upon man's economic activities. On the right, man's disobedient response, which results, of course, in God's judgment. And we said at the beginning that economics arises out of two basic biblical principles. First of all, the cultural and industrial mandate to have dominion over the earth and replenish it. And secondly, out of the Genesis curse, thou shalt eat thy bread in the sweat of thy brow. And the whole of economics is basically a study of the interaction between these two ideas. And of course, part of the cultural mandate is the great economic law of stewardship. Now we're going to see how these ideas from Scripture apply to the international realm. So far we've been dealing with the analysis of the system here at home. So far our analysis of American capitalism has been based upon the assumption that it is a closed or isolated economy. This obviously is not true. The American economy is linked to other nations of the world through a complex network of international trade and financial institutions and relationships. First then, why do nations trade? What is the basis for trade between nations? First, there is the reason given in the Bible. International, no less than domestic trade, rests upon the common grace of the Lord, which enables men to specialize in production and to keep contracts in their business dealings. Gary North suggests that international trade may be traced back to the age following the Genesis flood. In his economic commentary on the Bible, published in the February issue of Chalcedon for this year, North points out that God, after Babel, and I quote, "After Babel, God scattered men geographically. Economically, this was crucial. The flood had erased the universal climate of the ancient world. Mammoths no longer munched foliage in Siberia. A jungle no longer bloomed beneath the ice of Antarctica. Men would now live in terms of different climates and varying agricultural resources. They could specialize in economic production, a necessity given the effects of the ground's restraining curse of Genesis 3:17-19. Men desire more wealth. To attain their goals, they are forced to cooperate economically through trade. Self-interest restrains the lust for blood in men's hearts. Through the curse of the ground of Adam's sin, God was forced to add the diverse climates to restrain the sins of Noah's descendants. And finally, the diversity of languages for Babel's rebellion. At each stage, God provided economic incentives for voluntary trade and commerce. Men would pursue increasingly specialized and therefore increasingly productive occupations. The scattering at Babel, says North, must be seen as accomplishing a twofold political goal. First, it restrained the creation of total political unity. Second, by providing teachable languages to the scattered population, God restrained the creation of total anarchy and total nomadism. Scattering, given the curse of the ground and the post-flood climates, provided a twofold economic goal. It restrained the creation of a centralized, socialized state, yet it also gave men an economic incentive to cooperate internationally despite the language barriers. End of quote. In the second place, international trade is the means by which nations can specialize in terms of the resources allocated to them by the Creator, increase the productivity of these resources by good stewardship, and thereby realize a larger total output than would otherwise be possible. When each nation specializes on what it does best, and then exchanges its products with other nations, mankind produces more in total, And each of us ends up consuming more than if each should try to be self-sufficient. Thus, Iowa does best if she specializes in producing corn and hogs, while Pittsburgh produces steel, when Chile produces copper, and Florida her oranges. The advantages to all in the above cases, to Florida with her oranges, Iowa with her corn and hogs, etc., are obvious. No sane person can question them. For each area to try to live alone, barring trade with others, would be foolish as well as contrary to the biblical norm of good economic stewardship of the earth's resources. The advantages to nations from specialization and exchange are identical. More is produced for all to consume. The case for free international trade is that simple and that powerful. By using our total resources most efficiently through specialization and exchange, the world can move all the way out to its combined production possibilities frontier. But owing to men's greed and sinfulness, they have refused time and again to recognize and abide by this truth, and they have erected all kinds of trade barriers. In doing so, they have invited the Lord's wrath and brought upon themselves a lower standard of living than they could have enjoyed. In international relations, no less than in personal relations, disobedience to God's great laws to mankind must result in poverty, misery, and inefficient use of resources. And now we come to one of the great principles of international economics, the principle of comparative advantage. Given the God-ordained differences between nations and their location on the earth's surface, it is clear that some international trade will be advantageous if each specializes in producing those products they can produce with the greatest relative efficiency, and trading for those goods they cannot produce efficiently. The greatest possible advantage for all from trade will be obtained if each nation devotes itself to what it can produce relatively most cheaply. Thus, Iowa should produce corn and hogs, Florida oranges, so as to produce the greatest total of hogs, corn, and oranges. But the money cost comparisons in this example do not provide much guidance when it comes to comparing costs between nations that have different proportions of the factors of production. Different monetary units, different qualities of labor, different productive techniques. Perhaps, as between coffee and machinery, Brazil has an absolute advantage in coffee, but the United States in machine tools. But even in such an extreme case, it is hard to be precise on just why we are sure that these absolute advantages exist and what they mean. When less striking differences are considered, such as textiles in the United States and the United Kingdom, the difficulty of such comparisons becomes insurmountable. Monetary comparisons means little, since different monetary units prevail in the two countries. But fortunately, as David Ricardo demonstrated over a century and a half ago, in his great work, The Principles of Political Economy and Taxation, the advantages of international trade do not depend on such absolute cost calculations at all. Even though one nation were more efficient than another in the production of everything, it would still be to the advantage of both nations to specialize and engage in international trade. Each and both combined would gain most when each specializes in the production of those commodities where its comparative or relative costs of production are lowest within each country. Ricardo's interest in foreign trade was first aroused during the British parliamentary debates in 1815 over the so-called Corn Laws, which prohibited the import of foreign grain until the price of domestic grain rose above a certain level. Of foreign trade, he argued, such policies would lower the British standard of living. Indeed, he contended, any nation that prohibited imports would be injured, even when it was absolutely more efficient than its trading partners. Ricardo based his proof of this proposition on a simple world contained only two countries,
England and Portugal, and in which labor was the sole factor of production. Details of a model, similar to the one Ricardo had in mind, are summarized in the table below. In the above model, we consider the amount of labor time required to produce 100 square yards of cloth and 100 pipes or casks of wine in both countries. The table shows the Portuguese worker is more productive in producing both products. Nevertheless, at the pre-trade opportunity cost given in the third and fourth lines of the table, it would be to Portugal's advantage to export wine to England in return for cloth, to England's advantage to export cloth to Portugal in return for wine. Portugal, that is to say, could ship 100 pipes of wine, the product of 80 hours of labor, to England, where it could be exchanged for 120 square yards of cloth. To produce 100 square yards of cloth requires 90 Portuguese man-hours. So to produce 120 square yards of cloth requires 108, that is 1.20 times 90 Portuguese man-hours, 28 more hours than it took to make the wine. For its part, England could ship 100 square yards of cloth, the product of 100 hours of labor, to Portugal, where it could be exchanged for 112.5 pipes of wine. To produce 100 pipes of wine in England requires 120 English man-hours, so to produce 11.25 pipes requires 135 English man-hours, 35 hours more than it took to make the cloth. Now please turn over to page 3. Go to the last paragraph at the bottom of page 3, please. On page 3 above, I simply give another example, in case you haven't got this idea of comparative advantage. From this principle of comparative advantage, we can tell how far it is advantageous to carry specialization in trade. Underline the next point. Gain from trade is possible until the cost ratios of producing the two commodities are the same in the trading countries concerned. An example above, of course, United States and France. With constant costs, complete specialization would occur. The cost ratios never become equal since they are fixed by the constant cost assumption. But now, realistically, drop the assumption of constant costs. As production of cloth, for example, increases in the United States, as production of wheat, an example we discussed above, increases in France, the cost ratios would move together. In the United States, the cost of producing cloth will rise relative to producing wheat as more cloth is produced. In France, the cost of producing wheat will rise relative to the cost of producing cloth. Finally, at some level of output, the cost ratios will become identical here and in France. Thereafter, there will be no advantage in further specialization and exchange, since no further increase in total output can be obtained thereby. Realistically, we should also introduce transport costs between nations, which would correspondingly reduce the potential gains from international exchange. When the law of comparative advantage is generalized to many countries and thousands of products, no new principles are introduced, but the picture becomes more complex. Gains will still be maximized if each country specializes in those goods and services where its comparative advantage is greatest. And if this specialization is carried to the point where the cost ratios involved are equal to those of other countries producing the same products. In any given country, production of many products will never take place because the country's comparative disadvantage is so great and because of international transportation costs. Most nations will find it to their advantage to produce a variety of products. In world markets, the search for profits and the price system tend to bring about this international specialization and optimal allocation of resources in each country automatically. If the United States is relatively inefficient in producing coffee, but very efficient in producing machine tools, then American producers of coffee are going to have a tough time competing with Brazil in the world's coffee market. But we will beat them in producing machine tools or automobiles. Hence, if Brazil concentrates on producing coffee and the United States specializes in producing autos, then both countries will be acting as responsible stewards of the resources and talents given to them by God. Under an international free trade system, in each country, the greatest profits can be made by producing those goods and services most desired by consumers at home and abroad. If the United States' comparative advantage is great in producing autos, this fact will be reflected in high returns and profits in the auto industry. If our comparative advantage is low in producing spices, American spice producers will be unable to pay wages high enough to bid resources away from the more efficient auto industry, since the world price of spices is set by the relatively more efficient production in the East Indies. Thus, under a free price system and free trade, the resources of each nation would tend to be drawn into its most efficient industry. No one would manage or direct international trade. Each producer would simply try to maximize profits, and each buyer would simply buy where the price was lowest for the commodity he wanted. To provide the full advantage of international specialization and exchange, trade must be multinational or multilateral. That is, goods and services must be enabled to move freely among all nations. This eliminates the necessity that the exports and imports between any two nations must be imbalanced, which would severely restrict the degree of international specialization. Vis-a-vis all other countries combined, a nation's exports and imports must roughly balance, omitting capital movements. But with multilateral trade, this balance may result from a combination of export and import imbalances with different individual nations, depending on the individual country's comparative advantage involved. Thus, the United States, for example, exports more to Europe, Canada, and non-tropical Latin America than it imports from them. But our imports from the tropical nations exceed our exports to them. European countries, however, export more to tropical countries, and with the funds thus obtained, the tropical lands can pay for goods received from the United States. We pay them indirectly through our trade with Europe. Please turn over the page to page 5. Now we come to the vexed question of free trade versus protectionism. Unfortunately, men and nations are no more prone to obey God's laws and principles for economic than they are to obey any other of his economic laws. Ever since Adam Smith launched his attack on the old mercantilist barriers to free international trade in the wealth of nations, governments and special interest groups have continued to put forward arguments for protective tariffs and import quotas. The most recent example being Senators Hartke and Burke's bill in the Senate designed to limit the quantity of imports entering this country. In 1972, Senator Vance, Hartke of Indiana, told his fellow senators, I quote, "A flood of imported shoes, television sets, textiles, radios, calculators, as well as steel and machine tools, have entered the American market. In many cases, whole industries have been wiped out. Quality cameras, portable radios, electronic calculators, and many other items are no longer produced in this country at all. The most immediate victim is the American factory worker. Despite years of rhetoric about adjustment assistance and feeble attempts at reducing foreign barriers to American exports, we are faced with mounting unemployment. The time for action is now." If enacted, the Hartke-Burke bill, probably the harshest measure ever aimed at curtailing international business and trade, would 1. Require that the undistributed profits of overseas subsidiaries be taxed in the United States in the year in which they were earned, 2. Sharply increase corporate taxes by disallowing credit for income taxes paid to foreign governments, 3. Impose stricter depreciation rules for U.S. direct investment abroad, 4. Establish a new federal agency with strong powers to restrict imports by maintaining them at 1965-69 levels. A provision that could reduce imports by at least 25% from their current level. And five, give the President broad powers to inhibit the transfer of capital to or between the subsidiaries of U.S. corporations abroad. On August 1915, Black Friday as I call it, 1971, President Nixon had already placed America's trading relations with other nations in great jeopardy. First, he ordered the termination of the convertibility of the dollar into gold and other reserve assets. Second, Nixon ordered a 10% surtax on all dutiable imports. This was designed as a bargaining device to be withdrawn when foreigners had made adequate concessions to American demands, which extended beyond the realignment of exchange rates. The Secretary of the Treasury, Connolly, justified this new policy on the ground that the Western European nations' trading policies were too restrictive and discriminatory against American exports. But he made no mention of similar protectionist policies in the United States. Worldwide resentment against the import surcharge was enhanced by its blunderbuss nature. It applied indiscriminately to exports of countries with deficits in their balance of payments, as well as to those with surpluses, to underdeveloped, as well as developed nations, to countries with liberal trade policies, as well as to those that were highly protectionist. Whatever may have been the merits of the import surcharge as a bargaining weapon, it presented at least three dangers: that the resentment it created would make it more difficult to arrive at acceptable realignments of exchange rates; two, it would lead to an international trade war; three, it would further encourage the already growing protectionist sentiment in the United States. The issue of free trade versus protectionism is therefore still a very much live issue, one which all Christians should try to understand. On the one side are the protectionists, who wish to protect domestic industry by means of tariffs and import quotas in order, they claim, to stimulate domestic employment. On the other side are the free traders, who argue that trade restrictions will hurt our export industries and will increase prices to consumers. Let us deal first with the arguments in favor of high tariff walls and import restrictions. Now, I'm not going to go over all this material. I'll just draw your attention to the arguments for protection. First, the infant industry argument. This argument contends that protective tariffs are needed for the purpose of allowing new domestic industries to establish themselves until they're able to stand on their own feet. And the second argument, and there I also give the arguments against each one, but I want to deal with the most important one, I think, number three. The second one is number two, the national self-sufficiency argument. The argument here is the protective tariffs are needed to strengthen industries producing strategic goods and materials essential for war. In a world of international tension, every nation wants to be as nearly self-sufficient as possible in the event of war. The political desire for economic self-sufficiency may override all other considerations, regardless of what the cost may be. And number three, we protect our home industry argument. Perhaps the most popular argument for the tariff is that we need it to protect American industry against low-cost foreign competition. A domestic industry asking for tariff protection argues that without protection, its market will be lost to foreign competitors. This will force the domestic industry out of business, throwing workers out of jobs and decreasing our national welfare. Now, suppose that the industry is right. If it does not receive protection, it will lose its market to foreign competitors. What are the effects of giving the tariff protection the industry wants? The first effect is, underline this please, that domestic consumers may pay more for the protected product than if it had come in free. If sugar comes in over the tariff, consumers must pay the regular price of the foreign sugar plus the tariff duty. If the tariff shuts out foreign sugar, the domestic consumers must pay a higher price for domestic sugar. We know it's higher because domestic producers cannot, without a tariff, produce and sell at a price low enough to meet foreign competition. If they could, they wouldn't need the tariff. Thus, the tariff serves as the mother of monopolies, since it helps domestic monopolies to exist without fear of foreign competition. And second, domestic sugar producers are subsidized by the tariff. They are enabled to charge higher prices than would have been possible if foreign competition had not been shut out. It is clear that domestic producers are the great gainers from a tariff on their products. In effect, therefore, a tariff is a subsidy to domestic producers, financed by consumers through higher prices for the protected product. Moreover, the more inefficient domestic producers are, the higher tariffs they need to protect them against foreign competition and the large subsidy they receive. And because of that, we have a resulting misallocation of resources and, of course, bad stewardship, both contrary to the great cultural mandate requiring good stewardship. A famous economist, Frederick Bastiat, put the free trade case against protection tellingly over a century ago in his satirical petition of the candle makers of Paris. "We need protection," said the candle makers of Paris in their petition. "Foreign competitors are bad enough, but it is the sun who is the most unfair competitor of all. Each day he shines and throws light over all at no cost at all. If only you could shut out the sun," pleaded the candle makers, "we could have a magnificent candle industry, giving jobs to untold numbers of workers." Should we protect American domestic industry against cheap foreign competition today using the same arguments as Bastiat's candle makers a century ago? And number four, and I think the one most people are familiar with because of the propaganda of our labor unions, the protect our high wages argument. Proponents of tariff protection frequently argue that tariffs are essential to protect high wages and the high standard of living now enjoyed in American capitalism. Cheap foreign labor, it is contended, will cause cheap foreign goods to flow into the United States. As a result, the prices of American goods and ultimately wage rates and the level of living will be driven down by this competition. The appeal is tempting, but fallacious. The argument falsely presumes that low foreign wages will automatically mean low prices on foreign goods, and high domestic wages mean high prices on domestic goods. This is not necessarily the case. Indeed, the argument conveniently ignores the fact that wage rates and per unit production costs are related through productivity. Hourly wage rates may be high, and unit costs and product price low if productivity is high. And what determines the productivity of labor? Basically, the quality of labor and the quality and quantity of the capital with which it is equipped. The consequence is high wages in the United States usually are accompanied by low unit costs and low product prices. Wages, underline please, are high in the United States for the simple reason productivity is so high. Again, the petition of the candle makers should suggest a fallacy with this argument. Would the real wages of the French workers have been raised by shutting out the sun? Would the French people have been better off? As the principle of comparative advantage says, the maximum real output will come when we allocate our resources to their most efficient, not their least efficient uses. Let us look at the argument in more detail. First, wages are higher in the United States than in other countries because of the high productivity of American workers. Anything that raises their productivity makes it possible for them to receive higher real wages, and each worker can receive his highest wage when he is working in the industry where his marginal productivity is highest. What happens when a tariff is passed to protect high American wages? The tariff shuts out foreign products and permits relatively inefficient American industries to grow up where otherwise they could not have existed, giving new jobs to American workers. But, as a result, American exports will fall off because foreign countries cannot buy from us unless we buy from them. Therefore, fewer workers are employed in the export industry. The net result is a shift of workers from relatively efficient export industries, where they would be situated under free trade, into less efficient protected industries. As workers move to lower marginal productivity positions in protected industries, the wages they can receive in the new jobs are necessarily lower than they could have been before the shift. The long-run result of a tariff is thus to lower real wages, not to raise them. People earn the most when they work where they are the most efficient. And here you see a fantastic difference. The international wage cost per unit of manufacturing output. Notice this, that the net output per man hour in the United States for 1966-61 was $3.89, hourly earnings 2.63, wage cost per dollar of output 0.69. And the highest, if you please, is the Japanese. So, completely fallacious to talk about the Japanese flooding our markets. Please turn over to page 8. Since 1960, wage costs per dollar of output have risen only slightly in the United States, substantially more in most other industrialized nations. Opponents of protection often use the argument of cheap Japanese labor, undercutting American wages. Suppose then the Japanese labor is paid only a dollar per day, and we remove all tariffs on Japanese imports. Won't American workers be forced to take much lower wages to compete? In analyzing this case, first we need to recognize that even though Japanese daily wages are much lower, it is not necessarily true the labor costs of Japanese producers are correspondingly lower. The Japanese workers get lower wages, but he also produces less than a day. Therefore, the labor cost per unit of output may be as much or more for the Japanese producer as the American. In the early 1960s, for example, the average hourly wage of Japanese industrial workers without fringe benefits was about 25 cents. That in America was about 2.50. But suppose, for example, in the Chinaware industry, that the hourly output per worker in Japan is 10 plates, then the labor cost is 2.5 cents. If the hourly output per American worker is 100 plates, the labor cost per plate would be only 2.5 cents too. Wage cost per plate per unit of output is the one that counts. The evidence is clear that although wages are lower everywhere else than in the United States, our unit costs are highly competitive in many industries. Our $30 billion of annual merchandise, and now it should be 1966, of exports is unmistakable evidence of that. America exports more goods than any other nation in the world today. Now, I think we can skip the rest of that. Please turn to page 9. Now, just give the positive arguments on behalf of free trade. Now, all that we have learned so far about international economics and trade leads us toward an inescapable conclusion. Underline, free trade is a necessary condition for the maximization of world output. When nations specialize in producing those goods in which they enjoy a comparative advantage and trade these goods freely with other nations, the result is a higher total world output, a rising standard of living for all the trading nations concerned, and a better and more efficient allocation of the Earth's limited natural resources. Hence, free trade is in accordance with the great cultural mandate of Genesis 1 to develop the earth and to dress it, that is, to treat it as good stewards of the Lord. Through free trade, based upon the principle of comparative advantage, the world economy can achieve a more efficient allocation of its resources and a higher material well-being. The resource mixes and technological knowledge and skill of each country are different. Therefore, each nation can produce particular commodities at different real costs. Each nation should produce goods for which its costs are low relative to those of other nations and exchange these specialities for products for which its costs are high relative to those of other nations. If each nation does this, the world can fully realize the advantages of climactic, geographical, and human specialization, and so best fulfill its great cultural, economic, and industrial mandate to have dominion over the earth, and to subdue it to God's greater glory and benefit of human needs. That is, the world as a whole, and each free trading nation within it, can realize a larger real income from the given supplies of resources available to it. Protection, barriers to free trade, lessens or eliminates the gains from specialization. If nations cannot freely trade, they must shift resources from efficient, low-cost to inefficient, high-cost uses in order to satisfy their diverse wants. A collateral benefit of free trade should also be noted. Unimpeded international trade deters the establishment of domestic foreign monopolies. As opposed to free trade, protection from foreign competition creates a domestic economic environment more conducive to the development of monopoly and the host of restrictive practices associated therewith. The economic effects of a tariff may be summarized into four main points. 1. A tariff raises the price of the imported good. Under free trade, the products of a foreign industry that enjoy a comparative advantage will be lower in price than the same goods produced by a disadvantaged domestic industry. The purpose and effect of a protective tariff is to lessen or eliminate that price advantage. 2. Consumers will be faced with a choice of either paying the higher price of the domestically produced good or paying the higher price of the imported good with the tariff. In this way, a tariff causes domestic consumers to lose buying power and adds to inflation. 3. Because the price of the good goes up, fewer units of the good will be produced. A tariff, therefore, reduces domestic consumption of the good. It also reduces world output. 4. A tariff causes productive resources to be reallocated to disadvantaged and less efficient industries. Under free trade, a comparatively disadvantaged industry will contract, and the resource once used in that industry will be reallocated to more efficient industries. This is precisely what has happened to New England. During the 1960s, many textile mills were liquidated, and a basic weakness was shown to exist in the leather and shoe industry. Some of the textile mills are now among those in trouble in the South. Had a political solution to the problem been adopted by means of a tariff, no doubt New England textiles could have been protected in a way that would have kept the mills going with employment and jobs as usual. But instead, New England industry changed in part of the manufacture of transportation equipment, electrical equipment, and instruments, to name only 3. This new type of manufacturing is more export-oriented and enjoys a better international competitive position. It has the greater comparative advantage we've been talking about. It uses higher skills from its workers. Thus, in the long run, the return to labor stands to exceed what it was and what it might have been in the production of textiles, shoes, and leather goods. The cost of a tariff, of course, is borne primarily by domestic consumers. A part of this loss will be distributed to the government as additional revenue. Part will be distributed to domestic producers of the disadvantaged good, who also will enjoy increased revenue. Part is lost to the entire economy through inefficient resource allocation. North points out that a tariff is a special kind of tax. It is a tax paid by importers for the right to offer foreign products for sale on a domestic market. Indirectly, however, the tax is borne by a whole host of people. You can read the rest of his argument for yourself. Another argument advanced for the use of tariffs is that one country can improve its terms of trade by imposing tariffs on imported goods. The terms of trade argument is effective only, and note this, if the trading partner does not retaliate by imposing a similar tariff of its own. If the other country retaliates, all gains are wiped out and both countries are left in a worse position than they were with free trade. Such retaliation and tariff war would be the expected course of action in most situations. This is especially true when the tariff-imposing nation is, like the United States, a major trading partner of many countries. Unilateral tariff action would cause severe economic damage to the exporting nations. They would certainly move to impose tariffs of their own. Wilhelm Röpke warned us in his book 1942, International Economic Disintegration, of the disastrous consequences, not only to world trade, but to world peace, of the consequences of such tariff wars. During the 1930s, a snowballing effect was produced as each nation tried to outwarn and out-trade its neighbors in a vain attempt to gain favorable trade positions with all other nations. The result was a serious weakening of international specialization of labor and production. As the United States becomes more dependent upon other nations for vital raw materials, including oil and minerals, such a tariff war on its part today and in the future may well prove suicidal. Raw material access has acquired a new importance for the United States. By 1985, this country, even if it achieves self-sufficiency in energy, as Nixon hopes, will be primarily dependent on imports for 9 of the 13 basic materials required by a modern industrial economy. In this situation, economic warfare will prove a losing game. This applies to other nations as well as to the United States. The United States, along with many other countries, is today dependent on the Arab nations for oil. But the Arabs, in turn, look to us and our allies for food, medicines, industrial machinery, consumer goods, military aid and technology, and the management skills of private investors. The Soviet bloc is not in a position to fill the gap completely if Western countries cut off these benefits in retaliation for future oil embargoes. Economic warfare, that is to say, is a game all can play. After making known the firmness of this position, the United States and other industrialized nations should, in their own enlightened self-interest, commit themselves to a policy of worldwide free trade and work to reduce all existing tariffs and import quotas. In return for our promise to reduce tariffs and import quotas, we can fairly ask that the developing countries assure the international community of reasonable and non-discriminatory access to their raw materials. The oil-producing nations and others need to be put on notice. They cannot wage economic war upon America with impunity. A major American effort should therefore be made in the forthcoming trade negotiations to incorporate in the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, what is referred to as GATT, some new and stronger rules not limiting the right to impose tariffs. It should be not only limiting the right to impose tariffs, but also the use of export or other controls for political purposes. Where countries are found to have violated the new principles and failed to adjust their policies in accordance with multilateral decisions, they should face the possibility of multilateral reprisal. And then I go on to quote Henry Hazlitt, who warned us about the futility of trying to impose protection. And he goes on to say that we've got to get back to a gold standard. It is with the monetary aspects of international trade we shall deal in the next lecture, and then we shall consider the old gold standard and the system which replaced it after World War II, and why it is now broken down. Meanwhile, let us summarize the argument of this lecture. From our analysis, we can draw a broad summary of the major economic effects of tariffs. In the long run, a protective tariff lowers real wages and the people's standard of living. It diverts resources from self-sustaining export industries to less efficient, protected domestic consumption industries, and it forces consumers to pay higher prices. As such, tariffs are both contrary to the biblical principles of loving our neighbor both at home and abroad. They express the sinful desire of special interest groups to benefit at the expense of the general public, and especially of the people who can least afford high prices. In the short run, advantages may be gained from imposing tariffs to aid input industries or reduce unemployment. However, new tariffs will increase domestic employment only if the almost inevitable retaliatory steps are not taken by other nations. For all these various reasons, then, I suggest that a Christian economics requires free international trade. I thank you.